Hello, everybody. This is Daniela Bien-Aimé, and welcome to another episode of the Bien-Aimé Post Podcast. Hello, everybody. This is Daniela again. Welcome to tonight's episode. I just want to check in to see if Ezeli Danto is on the line.
Yes, I am.
Ezeli, are you here with us?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. We can begin. Well, I have to say that I am so excited. I'm thrilled to have you here tonight. And I know it's been a couple of months that we've been trying to get this interview, to actually set up this interview. And before we begin, I want to definitely talk about some of the things that you've been doing, which you've been very busy, especially in the last year or so. And then I'm hoping to go over your bio so that way the audience can have an idea of who you are. In case, you know, we have some new listeners, they can definitely get some background about you. And then we're going to jump in right into the interview. So Ezeli Danto was actually chosen recently as an honorary for the 2018 Connecticut Women's Hall of Fame induction ceremony. And that's going to be held on November 5th, 2018 at the Connecticut Convention Center. And in addition to that, in January, she was also a headline for the Dramatis Guild of America. And it's a new multimedia performance piece titled, How Do You Tell This Story to a Five-Year-Old? The United Nations is Not Party Trained. The Dramatis Guild of America is the oldest professional organization for playwrights, composers, and lyricists working in the U.S. theater market. And just last year, Ezeli was also featured in a documentary, The 1804, The Hidden History of Haiti. So she is an amazing woman. She is, I think, one of the most hardest working Haitian women in our community. And she's been doing it for a long time. And I want to continue with her bio. Ezeli Danto is also the leading human rights advocate for Haiti. And she has over 25 years of experience. She started out as a lawyer for the first democratically elected Haiti president. Attorney Danto is an award-winning playwright, performance poet, human rights activist, attorney, born in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and raised in the USA. She is a member of the New York and Connecticut Bar and is an internationally acclaimed fighter for Haiti women and children rights who work all over half a decade on one child sexual abuse case to bring to justice the first U.S. convicted charity worker who got nearly 20 years in federal prison for sexually abusing young boys for over a decade. Since then, she has worked on over a dozen other child trafficking, pedophilia, forced prostitution, and sexual abuse cases in Haiti to rescue Haiti's children. Ezeli Danto is the founder and president of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network since 1994 and the Free Haiti Movement since 2001. HLLN, which is the organization, supports and works cooperatively with Haitian freedom fighters and grassroots organizations promoting the civil, human, and cultural rights of Haitians at home and abroad. And of course, you can visit her at www.ezelidanto.com, and I'll share that information in the notes as well. Ezeli Danto is widely interviewed on Haiti matters. She's a scholar. She's also a Haitian historian and cultural activist. And her information may be found on the Huffington Post Live, The Real News Network, InfoWars, Artsy News, Black Agenda Report, San Francisco Bayview, Radio Radio Resista, and most local Haiti radio and news outlets. She has been featured on the Carl Nelson Show, the Felipe Luciano on WBAI, the Roger Stone Show, the Mark Steiner Show. I mean, she's been all over the place. Nightside with Dan Reed, the Mark Thompson Naked Plain Show. And she's been quoted on the New York Times, the National Bar Association Journal, Final Call, and on the Congressional Record as a Haiti and Caribbean human rights expert and political analyst. So she is just a powerhouse. Now, I want to continue. What most people don't know, Ezeli, and I just found about this last year, is that you are also on the ground in Haiti, and you have been one of the, leading Haitians working in the solar energy sector in Haiti. And in fact, you founded the Zibi Blue and Clean Water and Solar Power Energy Organization. And you have a very interesting story. So we should start out with the question that I asked during the promotion is, can Haitians lead the energy sector?
Yes. Honor and respect to you, Daniela. Thank you so much for having me. Honor and respect to all your audience. And I hope I can provide some important and productive answers to these questions that you're asking. Zili Dlo is a project of the Ezeli Network. The Ezeli Network, as you said, I started in Haiti in 1994. So it's been a while. So there's a lot of work out there. So we do cultural advocacy, media advocacy. We have two petitions out here, one about abandoned Haitian children for the UN troops, but I'd love for your audience to go and sign on the petition. We also ask people not to support the Dominican Republic because of how they're treating Haitians and the denationalization process. So we have two of those advocacy petitions out there that your audience could certainly sign and help us in our work. I use culture, Haitian culture, and indigenous Haitian culture to tell our story. We have the To Tell the Truth Haiti Forums, and we have the Free Haiti Movement. And the Free Haiti Movement is a 6-yearly historical commemoration of important Haiti dates, like August 14th, which was the beginning of the Haitian Revolution, September 20th to October 17th, which is about Jean-Jacques Dessalines, Haiti's founding father, and so on. We go throughout the year with the Free Haiti Movement. And the reason we do what we do, because the narrative on Haiti is what keeps Haiti impoverished and in repression. So when you ask, can Haitians lead the energy sector? That is a definite yes, we can. Obviously, because our ancestors left us a legacy and a nation for us to lead. And if we say we can't lead that nation, then, you know, there's no point having a nation. What is important to remember is that neocolonialism runs in Haiti, is running Haiti right now. And so anything you're going to do where Haitians are going to lead is going to be hard. It's going to require creativity. It's going to require perseverance. And it's going to require the unity of our people. So those three things is what we try to advance forward. Creativity, perseverance, and the unity of our people. And so what happened with us is that a lot of Haiti advocacy work, but in 2004, when the United Nations, as you know, and as Kwame Nkrumah said, it's a tool of empire. So I'm not going to go through all of those things because I'm sure your audience understands where we are, especially if they're Haitian. They understand what neocolonialism is, so we're not going to go through that. What I will say is that Haiti, there's certain things about Haiti, if you don't know, you can't lead us anywhere. Those people who know are the people I'm talking to. I don't really have the time to talk to people who don't have any education with regards to Haiti at this moment. But those who know, let me start like this. In 2004, there was this humongous flood in Guanaive, Haiti. Over 1,500 people died. And at that point, I was advocating for the end of the UN occupation. But what happens when you're doing legal work is that you also have to simultaneously provide an answer to the suffering people. And the people of Guanaive at that time were like living on rooftops for like 2 weeks because of the place was flooded. And we started looking for answers because those people were on rooftops. And I remember we were calling Haiti, getting people up to Guanaive to show people how to light to make food while they were on rooftop using the sun. And so that's how we began with our solar power. By 2010, after the earthquake, I had learned through the experiences of the regular hurricanes in Haiti that came about every rainy season, that we needed a more permanent solution than buying aqua tabs and sending it to Cité Soleil or buying sand filters. So we started out with trying to help the people who were on the rooftops learn how to use solar power to have power, to then doing aqua tabs so we can provide clean water during the hurricane season, then doing sand filters. So whenever we had some sand filters, for instance, in Guanaive, whenever another flood came along, all of it was washed away. So we knew we needed a more sustainable answer. And that sustainable answer came through clean water. After the earthquake, we kept getting a lot of complaints that the Red Cross was giving dirty water to the Haitians in the tents. So as a solution, I went looking for what could be a more sustainable answer, and we could provide clean water. So we purchased through a sponsor. It was Minister Farrakhan, because I went to everyone. I said, listen, they're not giving clean water to our people. It's 2010, 316,000 people were dead in 33 seconds, and we needed clean water at those tents. So we were lucky enough to convince one sponsor, as I said, to buy the Max Pure O1 clean water filter. And that's how we began with the solar power project in Haiti. And that was established in 2000, you know, right after the earthquake. I think 2011, if you guys want to go to, I'm going to try to give you references for those who don't know anything about us. You could see our first installation of the solar power water filtering unit. That solar power water filtering unit has the capacity to provide 165,000 families with clean water. They have the capacity, has the capacity to give you 30,000 gallons of water, of clean water. And we did a lot of research, actually before the earthquake, looking for a sustainable solution. And we had that run by women, different women organizations at that time. So that's the first project we did with solar power. But what we always wanted was a business system, a system that we would fund, but then at a certain point in time, it could run by itself. And I will tell you guys why. So that's the first thing we did. After the earthquake, we had the Max Pure O1. Anyone who wants to look at it can just, you know, put Max Pure O1 on YouTube. It's a clean water filtering unit. I found it that the United States military was using it in Afghanistan. I studied some of the Haitian oligarchs, and I saw that they were using it, and I said, you know what, I'm going to get this for the masses. And so that's how that came to be. The next year, the Max Pure O1 system is in Port-au-Prince, in the sort of center of where the earthquake was. And then the next year, we did an electricity project in two rural villages. and it met some of the criteria that the ESLI network had put together, which is that we didn't want to be like the NGOs. We didn't want to be like the government. We didn't want to do anything that was dependency. We wanted the people of Haiti to have the skills to be able to create and to create from where they are. So the 2012, I had found Barefoot College, and they had sort of really articulated the exact idea that I thought would be fantastic for Haitians. And so I will tell you a little bit more about that, but I hope that, you know, in order to answer your questions with regards to can we lead, we have to, I can give you my experience with Zili Dlo, clean water, skills transfer, and renewable power in the last 8 years. I know we can lead, but I also know you have to have perseverance, and it's not something that's going to be successful overnight, because there are very, very big, well, essentially economic development is war. So whatever economic development, if it's about local ownership, you're going to find folks that are going to be against it, because dependency is what the NGOs do and what the occupation does.
Okay. Wow. That was a lot. And I want to break that down a little bit, because I think what, at least for me, as a Haitian woman who's been following you, I think when we think about you in the community, we just see you as, you know, you're a fierce activist, and your work focuses mostly on, you know, children and women, and especially the abuse that the UN actually has imposed on Haitians in Haiti. So we know what you do. We know your credibility in the community. And what was fascinating to me was that you also have a business. You also have a business mindset. You understand that the only way that Haitians or Haiti will be able to truly move forward is if Haitians have ownership of it. And we know, and you know, because I was born in Haiti just like you were, and I was raised there. A part of my young adulthood and adult life, I would say, was in the U.S., but I am very, very, very intimate. I have a very close relationship with Haiti. And we know that from the time we can remember, it's been very, very challenging for Haiti to have electricity. And we know why, because if Haiti has electricity, that means that the country is actually going to develop. And the people who are not interested in Haiti being developed, they are going to make, you know, every effort to make sure that doesn't happen. But there's a shift. There's a shift happening. And I don't know if most people are noticing that. And you know that Haiti's president actually has promised since last June that within 24 months, Haiti will have, you know, electricity, you know, 24/7. I want to ask you, because you have your pulse on the ground, you understand Haiti, you understand the community. Do you really think that Jovenel will be able to deliver? Because already I'm sensing, based on the news that I'm following from Haiti, I'm sensing a lot of pushback. I'm sensing a lot of chaos. And that some of that chaos, I believe, is because of this electricity problem. Do you think it's going to happen? And if it is going to happen, what are some of the barriers that he's going to confront? Because it has never been done in Haiti. Can he really pull it off?
Well, it would be wonderful if Jovenel Moïse, who's a puppet of the mafia families in Haiti, actually did something for the masses. I think, based on everything that I know about Haiti, and I could be wrong, this whole chorus that's been going around since he was inaugurated in 2016 or 17, February,
yeah,
about a year and a half ago. I mean, that's the mm-hmm. chorus, is that, you know, Haiti's going to have 24/7 electricity. And I can say, from what I've seen, it's just been a chorus. And I'll give you an example. We do media advocacy for Haiti. So every major media news about Haiti, we look at, we at the ESLI Network. And if there is something that we can do to change whatever that narrative is, or push a narrative that is good for Haiti, we try to do that. We have relations with many progressive journalists. And I want to point to China Extends Her Silk Road to Haiti by Georgina Nineber, who's a great friend of the ESLI Network. And that was written in August of 2017. It's at Huffington Post for those who want to look at it. And you see, we wanted to push that, right? Because right now, the powers in Haiti are the traditional Western Europeans. And we wanted to give a room for another powerhouse to come into Haiti. And in that competition, perhaps Haitian people could squeeze in some electricity. But if you look at that, that was in 2017. And I'm saying this in relation to questions you asked me. Can Jovenel Moïse deliver on his 24/7 electricity? Well, he's been saying it for a year and a half. And I know for a fact that the mayor of Port-au-Prince had signed a memorandum of understanding with a Chinese company to provide electricity. And it was the Jovenel Moïse government that scuttled that. So I don't know to what extent they willfully scuttled it, but I do know that they're a puppet of the Western powers. And so they may have done what their masters wanted, because, of course, their masters are pushing, would not want China to be successful and be looked upon as successful in Haiti, when we have, for instance, the glaring failures of the Clintons and Obamas after the earthquake to do any sort of infrastructure. So these are the sensitive spaces that we live in. But within those sensitive spaces, we have to push. So if I saw that there's a possibility that perhaps we could use our weight to push for 24/7 electricity in Port-au-Prince, because the Port-au-Prince mayor is making a side deal with China, so we try to do that. Those are the type of push that we would do. But at the moment, China is not really going to risk its relationship with the United States by helping Haiti. Neither is Russia. So at the end of the day, even though we can play these Cold War games, at the end of the day, the development of Haiti is in the hands of Haitians.
That's right. No, I totally agree. And you know what? Something that's been a little bit challenging, because I don't think most Haitians really believe that they have the power to reject the current system and say, no, enough is enough. Why is it that Dominican Republic has electricity 24/7 and Haiti doesn't? In fact, I was on having a dialogue with somebody on social media, and the consensus is, the concept, the whole idea of providing electricity for all Haitians 24/7 is just very complicated. It's just very, and here's the thing, Ezra, because I want to bring this up, because last year I had a chance to interview this gentleman. He's the vice president of this company named Sigoa Haiti, and what they do, they're already providing 24-hour electricity in Mall Saint Nicolas. He was on, And in fact, he said that, you know, Moise has created some good policies with the solar energy sector, and that they just need to push it to, you know, to Congress to get it, you know, to get it going. But that company is making money in Haiti, and that company is from Silicon Valley. I don't think they have any association with the established institutions, because they're fairly new. And just I think about maybe a week or 2 weeks ago, there is an article that came out on Forbes magazine. And the article actually, it was very interesting how this woman just went to Haiti 2 years ago. Okay, 2 years ago, in 2016, she started a company in Haiti, and already the company is actually one of the leading energy companies in Haiti. So my question is, you know, Haitians keep telling me that, oh, it's complicated. It's, you know, we cannot leave. This is just too much. I'm looking for the article so that way I can actually read it. The title of the article is Solar Startups Brings Renewable Energy to Haitian Businesses, right? And the name of the company is Power 10, okay? Now, this is a woman, I've never spoken with her. And let me just say this to my audience. To me, it really doesn't, if someone is not Haitian and they go into Haiti to start a business, I think that's fine, provided that they do things legally and provided that they actually treat the people with dignity, meaning that they're paying them a livable wages, and then they're also providing, you know, good insurance. They are basically treating them the way that they will treat, you know, I guess the employees wherever they actually from, whether it's in the U.S. or Canada, because there are laws in the U.S. and also in Canada where you can't just treat employees the way that you want. But a lot of foreigners feel like Haiti is an open market. There are no laws. There's really not a lot that people can hold them accountable. So as a result, they go to abuse the community. So why is it that this woman, this is 2016, 2 years ago, she's able to go to Haiti and start a company, and someone will probably say, well, she's got, you know, she's got money, she's got the backup, but it's not her country. Haiti is not her country. Why is it that it's so easy for us to see that Haiti is better, you know, if somebody else, you know, starts a business there as opposed to us? And I want you to talk about the women, because one of the things that I understand that you did, which I thought was amazing, you basically were able to empower and send 4 Haitian women who were illiterate to become solar panel engineers. Is that right?
Yes.
Now, these women are not literate. I mean, they didn't know how to read. But yet you are able to see that, okay, they can still change. They can still start businesses. They can still, you know, help the community. They can still get out of the rut that they're in if you empower them not just through business but also culturally.
Okay, so the system that's in Haiti, especially the poverty pimping system, the way it works is that experts from abroad come to show the illiterate masses how to be civilized, to put it in colonial language. Our standing at the EDLI Network is that just because a Haitian person may not have gone to school does not mean that person does not have valuable skills that they could share in the community. So when we started to figure out what is it we want to try to do in Haiti that's different from the dependency syndrome, is recognizing that education, as defined by the West, doesn't necessarily is not education for Haitians. Education by the West is having a degree to maintain the status quo. So we always say the worst, most dangerous person in Haiti is someone with a degree. They have learned in another language that is alien to the Haitian people, and they are trained to go live abroad and finish that system. Whereas the Haitian people has an informal economy that we're always lifting up at the ESLI network that is the backbone of keeping the people alive. And then the only other thing that keeps the Haitian masses, and there's 13 million of us, the Haitian masses alive in Haiti, is the remittances of the diaspora.
Right.
So there's two economic models in Haiti right now. I'm not going to go into the drug dealings and all of that stuff that's going on, but two economic models. One is the NGO charity model, which is the reservation model. You keep the people with the bare minimum so that they can maintain the status quo, and you keep them dependent like they did the Native Americans in America. So Haiti is a big reservation with a bunch of NGOs who are working to maintain something that they'll never be able to maintain. It's only in the short term. They can't give you infrastructure. They can't give you proper education for you to break out of the poverty that they've put you into. They won't give you infrastructure in terms of electricity, shelter, healthcare, communication, internet. They can't do those things. Those things have to be done by the people of Haiti, for the people of Haiti, and that can only be done when you have a political arena that's going to support that. But they will constantly bring you these NGOs, and their whole thing, like I said, is employment for Americans, employment for this lady you're talking about, right? And because they have fetishized Haiti as, you know, needing these white saviors, we call it Avatar Haiti. If anybody wants to look at the Avatar movie, we are the glorification of misery, the glorification of Superman coming in and Tarzan coming in and being able to provide these miserable black folks with a little bit of reprieve, and this is what they do. So besides, that's the NGOs, and the NGOs are there to maintain the status quo, which is the occupation. Yes, there are some of them who at the end of the day will try to do something a little different, but when you have foreigners giving you education, there's no way those foreigners, especially their culturally consumerism or culturally looking down on Vodun or looking down on your language, or looking down on la cour combite and vive, or your system of being, they can't really do anything for you. And then you have a new sector right now that the leading example is Dennis O'Brien's cell phones. He's the first sort of success where they provide a service to the economic class of the masses. What you have to understand about that system is that the money comes from the informal economy, which no Haitian with a PhD ever recognizes, and the money comes from the diaspora remittances. That's the money that's paying Dennis O'Brien $2 billion a year. And what this lady you're talking about wants to do is replicate that Dennis O'Brien monopoly, and she can do that because the patients who are in power give more credibility to a foreign white woman, foreign lawyer, or a foreign Dennis O'Brien than they do their own people. Because I know for a fact that in 2011, when we knew that we had to be a solution because there was cholera that the UN brought to us in October 2010, and we were preparing a case against the UN in federal court in New York. So my thing at the ESLI network is always, when you state a problem, you have to also state the solution. And so we said, clean water is life, health, and dignity for Haiti. So that's why we went for the rural areas with this project that I found. And the project Barefoot College was really critically important because they were mirroring things that, you know, we had been saying, that the backbone of Haiti are the market women. They are the economic backbone. So we looked at them and we said, you know, how could we provide them with more opportunity and skills and access and technology? Haiti's at ground zero because they have no infrastructure. So it's like not in the United States, there's a big electricity grid infrastructure with natural gas and so on. Haiti, you have the sun and no infrastructure. And so we could provide infrastructure by using the sun, and the fact there's no grid, by creating our own grid. So that's how we started. And the thing about the project at Barefoot College was this. They've been around for 40 years. They had never been in Haiti. They were supported by the Indian government, which was important to us because we had always been fighting the Euros, the white settlers and the Europeans. And here was a country that was different and had never been to Haiti. And here was Barefoot College. They had a very unique system, and I want to tell people about it and the reason why we chose it. That system that they have ran parallel with what we are always saying, is that the Haitian market women and the Haitian informal economy, this is what young Haitians who have access can really focus on expanding. Because if you don't, and you think that you're going to come to Haiti and use your education to bring in the status quo, it's not going to happen. You have to expand what's already on the ground, and then that will make it sustainable. If it's community-owned, community-controlled, and so that's what we were doing. But here, Barefoot College had this kind of thing, right? They wanted women who were 35 or over. They said, we will take these women, even if they've never been to school for one day, and we will, within 6 months, make them solar engineers. This was very seductive and attractive to us, because that's what we wanted for our women. We wanted dignity, and we wanted them to have a little bit of what the NGO women and men had, going to a different country, traveling, learning a skill, and being able to come back home. This was a dream of a lifetime. The four women that we took from rural Haiti, two villages. The first village was in about 20 minutes from Port-au-Prince. It was called Font-Baptiste, a very remote village that had no electricity. And then the other one was another remote village in a place called Arcaillet. The village was called Font-Baptiste. The one in Pétionville was Au-Cadet. The one in Arcaillet was Font-Baptiste. So two villages, Au-Cadet and Pétionville, and then Font-Baptiste in Arcaillet. We let the village decide which of the women had enough connections, leadership skills, to represent them. So they're the ones that picked. We had certain criteria that were given. We wanted people that would not just take the education and then go away, go into the city and not be part of what we needed to be done. And so I think the Barefoot College model was so interesting to me because they did not use the spoken word to teach the mothers to be solar engineers. They used signs. And they had, in the class that I sent our women, 22 other countries, poor countries. Women were coming from Iraq, Afghanistan, all over India, Colombia, and so forth. And these women got together. None of them spoke the same language, and they were learning how to make inverters, how to make charge controllers, how to test electrical equipment, and how to put together these solar panels. And the intention was within 6 weeks, they would learn the basics of running a mini grid. Well, that was very attractive to us. It took us a couple of years to get it done, but we got it done, and we got the first class of women out of Haiti in 2012. We were able to prove that women with no school skills could use their hands and be of service at the highest technological way. Like, we were demystifying technology. As you said, you know, a lot of school Haitians will say to you, oh, this is, you know, Haitians can't do it because it's too technical. But here we had illiterate market women who had never been to Haiti. As a matter of fact, I had to get the identification cards of many of them that didn't even have a birth certificate. I mean, when I say this was grassroots, this was grassroots. And we got them to India. And within a week of being there, the predators came. You know, I'll always remember it. Michelle Bachelet, for instance, who is now the current president of, I believe, Chile, was taking pictures with these women who couldn't have dreamed that they would be with a president of a country. But she was, at that time, the head of UN Women, which is a part of the United Nations. And once they realized we were doing this, of course, they came to try to destroy that project. But I did end up doing it to the best of our abilities with the level of money we had to finish it up. The women got the education. They came back as solo engineers. They went. Purpose was they were going to run a energy grid. I would provide the women. Esli Dumptall's Esli Network would provide the women, the Haitian knowledge, the all that was needed to and then the Barefoot College would provide the education and the equipment. At the end of the day, after 6 months, when the women came back, because they had no control of Zili Dlo, my organization, and because there were so many people within the Haitian oligarchy and within the occupation that did not want Zili Dlo to be successful, that exclusive contract that we had, and we had an exclusive contract to bring every 6 months more Haitian villages, more Haitian women to India, so that, you know, my sort of vision, our vision at Esli Network, was that we would electrify, or, you know, over 300 Haitian electrify over 300 Haitian villages, rural villages. And that was the dream. That's what we started. But after that first class, out of the blue, Barefoot College was no longer working with us, and we were left without the equipment. So what we did was we said, fine. We went and we did phase one and phase two. So phase one, the villages put together something called the energy center. And all the people in the village contributed to building the energy center, and then we gave them the solar panels. And I have to remember this young man's company, but there, you know, you were telling me about this woman, this white woman who came in, and all of a sudden she's X, Y, and Z in the energy sector. But I can tell you that they get. These white folks, you know, they're at TED Talks and so forth, you know, with the colonial narrative of saving the, you know, the Haitians. But there were, in Haiti, when Barefoot College reneged on their deal with us because the Clintons gave them an award, the Citizenship Award for the Clinton Global Initiative, and then we didn't hear from them. But we had the solar engineer women who stayed with us. Yeah, we had a contract with each of the villages, and we went to a young Haitian solar panel manufacturing company in Haiti, and they provided us. So there are Haitian solar panel manufacturing companies in Haiti. They're just not getting the sort of marketing boost that this other person is getting, but they were there. And they gave us those solar panels at below market price and helped us finish that project. And it was a Haitian manufacturing company.
Wow. So
So, Ezeli, hold that thought because there are a couple of questions coming on the board. Actually, there's a lot of people. This is PNMA Post, and I am actually speaking with Ezeli Dito on her project in Haiti. She, believe it or not, in addition to her being an activist, she's also a maker. She's a doer, and she has a solar panel and water project in Haiti, working directly with the Haitian community and some with the Haitian women. So I'm going to call her 4644. I'm going to open your line. I see your question. And then also, Ezeli, I do have other questions from my readers. I told that I was actually going to ask you. So I want to get to that point as well. But caller 4644, your line is open.
How are you doing today?
I am well. Can you tell us your name?
Well, my name is Pianchi. I'm calling from here in the States. I'll listen to the conversation. You know, we have worked along the lines and done feasibility studies for things in Nigeria for upwards of 250 megawatt power stations. 3,300 metric ton per day ammonia producing plants, and also some big chicken farms where every 50 days they harvest about 400,000 birds. And what she's talking about is a good thing. We also were talking with some people on solar powered refrigerator and freezers, and they are very efficient. Go from anywhere from 9 cubic feet, 14 cubic feet, and 21 cubic feet. Now, I could share that information with her. I don't want anything from it because it's just not my cup of tea. But people come to us with that information. And, you know, you may be able to use it over there. The fact that you get so much remittances from here in the United States, from Haitian and the diaspora, if they could come to some consortium and be able to put together some outlet where you can source these refrigerated freezers and be able to provide them. And they're not too expensive, they're pretty economical. Where you are, there's one model that would work very well, but in Africa on the equator, they have to be built a little bit more different. So I just wanted to share that.
Wow, thank you. So let me ask you something. Do you mind if I just take down your number and I can make sure that I connect you with Ezeli and then you guys can take it from there? Ezeli, are you comfortable?
Yeah, I can give you my email address, which would be better. It's a business email address. That would be better.
Right.
It's L as in Larry, C as in Charlie. The word steel, like the metal, STEEL. At Mindspring, like in your head, MIND, and springs like on a car, SPRING.com, Mindspring.com.
Is that the name of your company or not? Yes, I wrote it down.
That's the email.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And I'll make sure I'll include that on the
notes. Yeah, I will share that information with her and, you know, give her the contacts, and then she can make up whatever she wants. Like I say, I don't want anything out of it. I just want to see more projects like utilizing this technology's capabilities and provide, you know, those type of technologies to people like in Haiti, for instance, and elsewhere, too, on the African continent. You know, if you had a solar power refrigeration and you was at a medical facility, well, then you got the ability to keep your medicine at the proper temperature, and so on and so on. So that works out very well.
Right. Well, mm-hmm. It is really a development issue because as long as Haiti does not have electricity for the masses, because there are people in Haiti who have electricity, but I'm talking about for the masses, for the, like, you know, 10.0 or 9.5 million people, Haiti will continue to remain the bottom. And that is why I think as much as we're doing all these different, you know, projects, and we have to do the things that are hard so we can unblock the country. Because as long as people are not able to have electricity, I am so sorry, but you are not going to have great schools with great labs. That's just not going to happen because you do need electricity. You're not going to have businesses that are going to actually grow because you need electricity. And you're certainly not going to have hospitals because you need electricity. So to me, it is like, it baffles me that that is not the priority for every Haitian in Haiti and also every Haitian here in the diaspora, because that's what's really going to unblock the country.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. If you don't have dependable electricity, and then you have to have people that's able to afford even the minimal cost. So electricity and agriculture, where people can feed themselves, are two major things. You have to have dependable electricity. Then, of course, what would come next after that is water and sewage disposal. And then you're off to the races.
Right. Now, that sounds good. Thank you so much. No, Ezeli is pretty serious. I don't know if you know her work. You should probably Google her and follow her work. She's pretty serious about what she does. But she can tell you.
And I had a friend. We had a friend here that was in Haiti during the earthquake. She was with USAID. Her name is Regina Dennis. And she's here in St. Louis right now. She was in Ghana, then Guinea. And she went to Haiti and almost lost her life there during the tragic earthquake. But anyway, I wish this lady well. Get in contact with me.
Wait. I think Ezeli wants to talk to you, so hold on, sir.
No. I was just going to give the gentleman our email so that he's welcome. Okay. It's you can actually go to EzeliDantal.com, which is my name, EZILIDANTO.com, or you could write to me at ERZILIDANTO. That's ERZILIDANTO@yahoo.com. And certainly we need all the help and partnership that we can get. But I have to say that our energy centers, we were training folks on how to dry freeze agricultural goods so that they can sell them. And so we did use in another project that we had, because this is not the only project that we do, the solar power in these two villages. With another project, we did have solar power refrigerators. And in that process, like I said, we did train some women on how to freeze dry agriculture so that they can have a business. At the end of the day, this is my experience after 8 years of doing this. We want total control for the local communities, and we want total freedom. The business models of, you know, the USAIDs, for instance, are not about total control and total freedom. So our business models at this point is that we want the funding to be able, because I've learned the hard way that you can't run a sustainable project with part-time volunteers. You have to really pay someone to do the quality quantifying, to tell you who's working at the center. We need funding. So those are the things. That's the next step for us. For us to do anything with these two projects that we have in Haiti, which is run by solar panel, whether it's the solar panel filtering or the solar panel electricity, what we know now from our experience, we have to have a paid team and a system. And when I say a system, I'm talking about a system of operation that everyone who's working, that team can learn, for instance, a system of reporting, a system of marketing, a system of collecting money. So those are the things that we need to put in place right now. To do that, for instance, I'll give you an example. With the water project, if you don't have somebody on the ground to do the distribution, you know, someone can tell you it's being done. But we have the technology, for instance, to buy a camera, put it on there so that there is international verification, you know, that there is a distribution happening, because we can see it by just looking in our internet. So right now what we're looking for is, you know, partners who can help us with the funding of what we need to build this as a system. We have the pilot project, But to build it as a system, escalate it, is going to require some funding.
And, you know, another thing that you is very important is that you have someone that can supervise these projects to make sure that they come in on time, under budget, and they are producing and giving what they're proposed to do. In many cases, that has not been the case. It's, you read about it all the time. So, yes, what you just said is very important. Also, with the ability to put somebody on the ground that can supervise these projects, supervise the construction of these projects, and all the other necessary things that's required in order for it to work efficiently and also to be transparent, those have to, you know, be an issue and something that has to be worked out. But anyway, I'm going to continue listening. You guys go ahead and carry on.
Thank you, sir. All right. This is Nieneme Post, and I am live with Ezri Danto. I love doing this type of thing because I think it's all about connection, and I love social media for that because social media can really help us connect to really sort of like move Haiti forward. I want to go to some of the questions, Ezri, from a few of my blog readers, because I did promise them, so I want to make sure that I deliver. For the first question that someone asked was, I'm just going to read it verbatim, exactly as he actually has it written. So Haiti basically skipped the era of landline telephones. They leapfrogged, basically, they went straight into the cellular phone and benefited from the progression of cellular technology as its primary means of communication. Following the same pattern, do you believe that the Haitian people are driving the energy technology model that best fits their need and resources? Or do you think we, meaning I guess we Haitians, are waiting around to become, I guess, to be post-adopters of the whatever Western technology that is developed? That's a loaded question, but I'm going to ask it. And then you can go ahead and you can tell us, please.
Yes.
It's a mouthful.
Oh, yes. So, you know, the spirit of the question, I definitely understand. We are sort of the wild west, right? We have no infrastructure in so many different things. So I think the advantage of never having no infrastructure is that you don't have to get rid of or somehow make compatible. So I think that's a good thing that, you know, we skipped the landline part. Now we're skipping. We went straight to cell phones. We're gonna skip a grid of natural gas or whatever they're using for electricity right now. I think the diesel is what is used for the 38% of Haitians who actually do have electricity. But
yeah.
I think the rest of the, you know, right now we could go 100%, just like we went 100% from, you know, these sporadic landlines to 100% cell phones. We could definitely go 100% renewable wind and solar power to power Haiti. We can do that. That is not like mathematically something that's impossible. That can be done. Haiti has, like they said, you know, a lot of solar, a lot of sun power. But who is driving this right now? It's being driven by Haitian minds who believe in Western development. And really, it needs to be driven by the local population.
Okay. And that's where your project comes in, because your approach is the local approach. You want to basically give the people, you know, the resources, and then they can take it and run with it and create a different scenario for their lives.
Exactly. And why do I say that, right? It's being driven by the Haitian mind and the Haitian, because you see, Western countries were developed out of slavery, out of serfdom, but they want Haiti to be developed immediately without having subsidies from the government. It really can't be done. You have to give people a little head start. Otherwise, it's going to be Digicel all over again, the exploitation monopoly. Haiti is never going to, the local population is just going to be exploited if we have a bunch of foreign people who they're even though they're going to give you all of this lip service about the civil good of the people, it's all about profit. Right now, Digicel has a monopoly on the cell phone. It's destroyed all local phone companies. That's why when, you know, we want a partner who has the necessary technology, the necessary hardware for renewable, sustainable energy that is dedicated to public service, education, and whose primary motive is not for profit. And not even like short-term cost-effectiveness, which is the word you always hear about USAID, but renewable, sustainable public health, environmental safety, sanitary infrastructure, community development, local ownership. That's what we need in Haiti. To do that, you need people like me. You need Haitians, because the foreigner is going to want profit. So. And you need Haitians without the school Haitian mindset. The school Haitian mindset is useless to us, has been useless to us for the last 100 years, 200 years. You need the new Haitian mindset that says that I want to use the assets of this country to elevate the masses and give them the skills themselves. And so that's what we try to do. That's why it's called Zili Dlo. Clean water, solar power, and skills transfer. First, we know that the non-educated Haitian is going to be the creative window for Haiti. Most school Haitians who are taught by the NGOs and USAID spend their whole life talking to us about how the Haitians can't do anything for themselves. They're too uneducated. So we do the opposite, and we've shown it. We've taken four Haitian women who were illiterate, and they became solar models, mothers. Why? Because Haiti needs trade schools. Haiti doesn't need these highfalutin Haitians talking to us about, you know, Rousseau and Le Petit Prince. What they need is someone who knows how to fix a car. They need trade school. They need someone who knows how to use their hands. They need someone who could provide something valuable to assisting with, you know, whether it's mobile clinics or sustainable or education that's sustainable or renewable power. So in that way, for us, we look at what we have. Right now, we have a population of 13 million Haitians. And in those 13 million Haitians in Haiti, those who are educated have no way to apply that education except if they, you know, take a boat and go to Chile and become somebody's assembly plant person. But so what we need is, though, that's sort of like Barefoot College. That's what we were going to do, use the four women to create a trade school, to create more solar mothers, and then to work with what we wanted to do and some of the partners we're looking at right now, for instance, right, that might need that. Like, profit is not their first thing, because it's going to take a while to build a system that then runs itself. So right now we're looking at the HBCUs as partners with Zili Dlo. The HBCUs, which are the black colleges, but essentially we have right now, for instance, I know this is true because I'm looking at this, so let me tell it to you. We have, like, the HBCUs in America, many of them have a technology department. Many of them have teachers and professors who have created these amazing equipment, solar energy equipment. And we say, hey, listen, you use your equipment in my model village, and it could be your exhibit, but it will provide something to my people. So that's a model that we're looking at the moment. So because that's what we need. We need a model that can be scaled up. Maybe it could be at some point a profit or a profit center, but there has to be the education and participation of the community first. And then perhaps as it grows, it might be a profit center. Like we said, you know, when you have solar power and you have the people involved in it, and they already have their laku, and they could go ahead and do that mango, they could go ahead and do that avocado, and then you show them how to when you freeze dry one of those things, it lasts for a year. They could be selling that down the road, the village road, and be able to then do more, send their kids to school. The energy centers, our vision of those energy centers is that the local children don't have to come to Port-au-Prince to go to school and live as a vestavec with some family member. They could stay in the village, and we could create courses that's long distance and remote. They are able to take, and we take. So there's a lot of stuff that can be done with modern technology, and electricity and solar power can drive it.
Right. Yeah, I think we're gonna have, and hopefully you'll agree to this, because I think this is probably just the beginning of a conversation. But it might be good, like from time to time, because we do need to do a follow up. And I know that there are more questions, but from time to time, to really figure out how we can put power back into the hands of Haitians, so Haitians can actually lead in the energy sector. Because you're right, Ezeli. One question that I ask a lot, and I asked that on Twitter, and I've actually asked the CEO of Digicel, and I don't think most Haitians are asking that question. And the question is, Digicel is like the fourth largest private company in Haiti, because when you go to Haiti, Digicel is saturated. I mean, they permeate the place. Every other person works for Digicel. And the question that I always ask is, they've been in the country for over 10 years, for over a decade, and under their watch, Haiti is still the poorest country in the Caribbean. How is that possible? And then just, I think, about 2 years ago, Digicel was applying for an IPO. Now, I don't have anything against Digicel, so I don't want anybody to call and say, well, she's No, I do not have anything against Digicel. All I want us to do as Haitians, as a community, we have got to open our eyes and see what is going on. Clearly, the wages that these Digicel workers are earning are just keeping them at the bottom of society. Because it is not possible to be in the country for over a decade. And that is my concern about all these new companies, that are, flooding Haiti, that are flooding the market under the, and then it's so funny because in the article, there are three key words, and you should always be skeptical whenever people mention these three words, especially if they're not Haitians, and they're telling you that they're going to start a business in Haiti. Number one is that whatever they're going to bid is going to create a lot of jobs, right? Digicel has created a lot of jobs, but what kind of jobs are they? Are other people's lives moving upward? Is their presence in the country is so influential that the people are able to move from point A to point B? So if a company has been in Haiti and they actually have maintained the status quo, as a Haitian, we need to start questioning. I know for me, I do, because when I go to Haiti, I remember I went to Haiti last August, and I have some family members. They have two cell phones. They have two cell phones, and one of them is for Digicel. And one in particular didn't have a job, and I said, why do you have two cell phones, right, when you don't have a job? And I know that my parents are sending them money, and that money goes straight to Digicel. Nobody's thinking about that. So it's not really their money. It's really the Haitian diaspora's money that's going into the pockets of Digicel. And we are quite comfortable with that. And for me, it's problematic. And we need to wake up and say, no, We are not, it is not okay. If a company is going to Haiti and the lives of the Haitians are not going to change, they should not be in Haiti. So the government can let them in, but the community can actually block them. Because it is not right, as you said. It is, they need to focus on empowering the economic lives of the local community. And if it's not happening, they should not be there. So because there are a lot of multi-million dollar companies in Haiti that are making millions of the people, and yet their lives have not changed in 10, 15, 20 years. When are we going to say that that's not okay? That's not okay. So I'm going to move on. I know it's a lot. So this is Bien-Aimé Poste, and we are live with Ezeli Dantel. I'm so excited that we are having this discussion. Thank you so much for making this happen. I really appreciate it. The next question we're going to move on to from this reader, he says, do you see a need for the regulation for Haiti to be regulated, for the energy sector in Haiti to be regulated? If so, why? And then the other question, I guess you can kind of combine it. I guess this is regarding your project. Will you focus, when you do start your project, are you going to focus on a niche area? Or it's going to be, you're going to offer everything?
I'm always in favor of the local economy and whatever protection that we can give to the local economy, because it always works the other way. Like, for instance, right now, right, if Haitians decided to manufacture solar panels, right, I know that the Jovenel Moïse, and this is kind of a two-edged sword, we're not manufacturing enough, probably, solar panels, you know, to serve the entire need right now. I know that just recently, when he came into office, the Jovenel Moïse government lifted up all tariffs on the importation of solar panels. That's kind of good, and it's also bad. It's good in the way that since we are not manufacturing it, you know, but who in Haiti has money to buy the darn thing?
Right.
So who are they servicing, really? And the people who are donating, like the people I deal with, there shouldn't be any tax or tariffs anyways. So I don't know who is being served by taking tariffs off and not having, not regulating it. I just don't know. I don't think that's the Haitian masses. On the other hand, if someone told me that they were bringing in solar equipment and it was a donation to a company that's going to serve the people, I'd be in favor of that, because I think the people need some assistance right now. So I think it depends on what kind of regulation. I have a mixed feeling about taking out the tariffs for-profit companies, because I think Haitians have suffered enough. I think we should protect our companies, and I think for-profit companies that are doing business in Haiti should pay taxes and tariffs. But if you're a company who is providing a service to a not-for-profit, I don't think you should pay taxes on the importation of solar panels and other wind equipment that might help the people. So that's my answer in terms of regulation. In terms of a niche area, I had no desire to enter this humanitarian space. I'm a human rights lawyer. I am a performance poet. I am motivated, animated by telling the world about the beauty of my people, the beauty of my country. That's what I'm motivated by. That's what, like, feeds my soul. But in terms like running a solar power, clean energy, yeah, that wasn't really something that I had in mind or we wanted to do at the Ezeli Network, but the necessity became the mother of invention. And our, I would call it maybe niche area, is that we want relief for Haiti with dignity and healing. And that's our niche area. And since, you know, we were talking about suing the UN because they gave us cholera and the water was poisoned, we had no choice but to try to give the people clean water. So if that's a niche area, okay, it came out of that. And then from there, when we went to the rural villages, it worked better to use to give the women the education to send them to this place. And then, you know, once we did that, we realized that we have these beautiful 13 million people who have all of this energy that's being wasted. When you go to Haiti, you see all these young men on the streets, you know, just waiting for some leader to show them how to channel that energy. If I drive a car in Haiti, I can't tell you how many times, like, say if I got a flat tire, within like 2 seconds, there's 10 young kids out there looking to help me. All that energy, whenever I see it, I say to myself, you know, why isn't it being directed? And so instead of asking that question, we started doing that. And that's why we did renewable power, clean energy, and skills transfer. But what has unexpectedly came out of that, which I'm interested in, is sort of the artwork. Once you give electricity to someone and they have access to, let's say, not only the phone, but they have access to the internet, you see these young men who want to create. And so, you know, I'm just interested in seeing how the local people actually create with this energy. So they might, you know, go beyond the niche area of electricity and water. And I'd like to see that. I'd like to see someone make a movie. I have had that happen, where a young man who used our electricity got himself a camera, and he's making movies for his local village that he shows at the, you know, that he shows out. So I want to see more of that. I want to see what sort of invention Haitians could do with power and access to the internet and the world. And so I would like to see Haitians themselves take what they have, you know, the power, and go beyond the areas that, you know, we saw as a necessity.
Excellent. Wow, this is great. I know we're all getting ready to wrap up. We've been talking for a while. Ezeli, I want to also give you the chance to share with the audience, because you do have a newsletter that you send out, and I follow your work with the newsletter. Is there anything else that you want to share that in terms of, I know you shared earlier, you gave your address, but what else should people expect from you? Like, what else is next that you are working on? We know that this is important to you and you're going to focus on it. Anything else that we need to know as a community that we need to understand?
Yes. If patients don't understand that there are these economic blocks to both Haitians in the diaspora and local Haitians, and those economic blocks is what I call neocolonialism. And this is when you have sham elections and you have, for instance, Digicel. Digicel played an important role in putting Jovenel Moïse into power. They use the access to technology to further strangle Haitian autonomy. And so every month, Dennis O'Brien walks into Haiti with his private plane and takes out gobs of money in American dollars to go pay his bills. And he got it from the Haitian masses. That gobs of money that he takes out every 4 weeks has a negative impact on the economy of Haiti because it makes the dollar higher. So in 2010, before Martelly was in office, the Haitian good was something like 42
to a
dollar. Right? Today, it's over 70 goods to a dollar because Digicel is exporting the dollar in Haiti and bringing up the inflation, and there's no regulation. There's no capital regulations. He does this. This is where Haiti is the fiscal paradise for these monopoly capitalists. Remember, Haitians are capitalists, but the monopoly capitalist is what's bad, right? Because the Haitian market women,
right,
they grow their product and then they go as capitalists to the market to sell, right? So we are.
Right.
We also socialists in the way that we are. We have the Laku, we have the Liv, we have the Combeat, and so on, communal property. We have, this is what we call our Combeat. So Haitians have to first understand what we have, what's indigenous to us, what got you here to America, right? Your mother's, Madame Salah's efforts. And then you have to understand that right now they're using technology to maintain Haiti's oppression and repression, and you have, you know, five or six mafia families from the Middle East that control all of the ports. Once you understand that in your colonialism, then you understand that creativity, perseverance, and hard work can change it. Yes, you can do Zili Dlo. You can take your own village, right? I always advise Haitians to do this, okay? Don't go trying to do something big, something small. Say, I'm going to electrify my own village. I'm going to follow
right.
the, let's say, Occidental model. I'm going to find a Haitian company in Haiti that makes solar panels, and I'm going to work with my community in the United States and follow the ESLI model and purchase in order enough solar panels and solar grids and train my own people to maintain that in my own village. You can do it. You know, but what happens is that Haitians want to be politicians. They want credit. They want, you know, they want to be like the white man, really. They want to, like I said, be politicians. And politicians are not going to do anything good for Haiti. They have not done
right.
anything good for, not because they don't have the intention, but because as soon as you have power or you become a known politician, you're going to have the neocolonialists breathing down your neck.
Right.
So it's those of us who are outside that system. And so I'm talking to Haitians in the diaspora. You have so much power with the remittances, that almost $3 billion. Why are you letting USAID tax it and giving it to Digicel? $1.50 they make from that cell phone you send to them. What happens to that money? $1.50, what is it? I'm sorry, 5 cents. Digicel is getting from the diaspora, in addition to the diaspora remittances paying the money of your family. They're taking that 5 cents every time you call because they have a monopoly. And the Western Union is getting $1.50 from your remittances because they have a monopoly. Okay, let's say we just let that go because we can't do it. You know, we just let it go. But if you do, don't do anything. We at the ESLI Network, we're looking to sue them in a class action suit. We want that money to be able to help develop Haiti. You can come and help us with that.
Did you start the process already?
Yes.
Did the network start the process? Okay.
We're looking for defendants. Defendants who can prove that since 2011, when this extra tax was being administered by the Matéli government, that you can prove that you send money to Haiti and you have access to that proof. So we're looking for defendants, you know, that can be part of this class action lawsuit. With regards to Zili, that's our legal advocacy work. Another part of our legal advocacy work is we have a Haiti petition because the UN left about 100,000 children that it had since 2004 to 2016 when it left. I'm sorry, 2017 when it left, October. There's about 100,000 children abandoned to Haitian women to take care of. And we have a petition out there, and we're building up that petition. So if you want to go ahead and sign it, we have delivered to the UN, and we want to preserve our rights. Because within a year of minister leaving, that's going to be October, you lose your right to bring action. And they can destroy all of the, you know, since 2004, we have been sending letters to the UN about these children. They could just destroy that. So the petition is to preserve our rights and to not have the time lapse. So come and sign that. Help us sign that. Also,
if you can send me the link, I'll share it also on social media for those who are following me, the Jasper, because I think that's important. I think that's important that people. I didn't realize that the deadline was approaching in October, yeah. And then once it's passed, you can't
really
do anything.
Yeah, the deadline is approaching in October, and I'm saying this publicly, yeah, to the United Nations. On as many interviews as I can say, we want them to know that we have that Haiti petition. We're not part of the Haitian government, so we can't go like the government could ask on behalf of the abandoned children and the children who were raped for justice, but they're not. So we have to do it, and we have to save their rights for the future when there are more Haitians with access, more Haitians with money. So that's what we're doing. We're doing the minimum that we can do with the resources that, we're doing the maximum we can do with the resources that we have. So sign that Haiti petition. I want to thank you, Daniela, for you signed it at the very, very beginning when we put it out. And then we also have boycotting the Haiti, because there's no one really protecting us. So we have to protect us. So we do have a petition where we asking people, don't go to the Dominican Republic and give them your tourist money. If you are in the Haitian diaspora, or if you are any person of the world and you want to support Haiti, you know, go to a local Haitian inn. Go to a local Haiti. You know, we have we can show you the riches of Haiti and how you can tour the beautiful riches of Haiti, right? How you could go to the Citadel, how you could go to the Lake Azue, which has 11 species in it that's extinct, that's nowhere else in the world. How to go to Bois Caïma and the spaces of our spiritual places. This is what we do. We tell people of the indigenous Haiti. So, you know, you can write to us if you want to plan a trip to Haiti. We encourage everyone to spend your dollars in Haiti. That will help the local population, you know, and don't try to go to some of these Marriott hotels or whatever. You know, there are Haitians who have Airbnb that you can go to. Go do that, you know, help the local economy. So we those are the things we ask. You know, don't go to the Dominican Republic. The Dominican Republic is hanging Haitians. And I mean that literally. So those are the things, those in terms of legal advocacy, those are the three things you can do to help us. You can do tell the UN to stop being pedophiles in Haiti. You can tell the Dominican Republic to stop the discrimination and deporting of Haitians and making apartheid legal in the Western Hemisphere. Definitely assist with Zili Blow Clean Water by making a donation. If you go to my YouTube channel, just put Nancy Duncan Haiti and get my YouTube channel, you can find our donation button. You can make a $5 donation renewable every month. You know, the more we have, the better we can continue this. We've been doing this for 8 years, and I can say to you, we have not been able to scale up because we have not been able to hire, like, a manager to watch and do everything. You can't run that type of program on a long-time basis with part-timers or volunteers. That's the lessons I've learned. And so right now, essentially, we haven't done anything except the energy center, and then we gave each of those energy Faubatif and Okade a public solar lamp so that they can have a focal point. But other than that, we haven't been able to do anything else in that village. As I say to you, Barefoot College is supposedly now in Haiti. I have no idea what they're doing. I don't know if they've ever done a second class. But they try to keep using our class as their success. You know, from time to time, my villagers will say, "Oh, Belfast College invited us to the ex embassy to come and take pictures." You see, when they didn't do any of it, we did it. But you can look at all those pictures on Facebook. You can look at, or just go to my Esli Dantal Facebook public page and look at the album section. You see some of the work that we did. And we're very proud of that work, but we wish that we could actually do more. But we can't do more without funding and putting systems together that we can then be able to tell our funders, you know, we get the reporting. We, you know, those are the things we're looking to do. And then, of course, we do media advocacy. If you want to be part of the, join the ESLE network, you will get like, you know, weekly ESLE network media advocacy post. It will deal with Haiti, or and it will deal with the global black world in one way or the other, and some of the things in the news that we see that is of interest to our community. So that's what the ESLE network is. So, but thank you for having me. People can go to ESLEDownthought.com. You can go to our YouTube channel. You can sign those two petitions. And certainly, if you want, you could assist us to move forward to do more by making a donation to the Zinidlo Project, which you can do, like I said, by going to the YouTube channel. You'll find the donation button there.
Sounds good. And I think the other thing that you mentioned that I'm interested in as well, Ezeli, is the Haitian company in Haiti that's making solar panel, because I think they also need some visibility. And as you know, I write about emerging businesses that are coming out of Haiti, but at the local level. So I'd love to know who they are so I can write about them, because I think it's important that people know that they are Haitian businesses in Haiti. You know, and that's another reason why we need more Haitians in the media, because you don't need, you know, you may not have Forbes magazine, but you can certainly reach the heart of your community, because we know the community and we are in the community. So I'd love to, I think that would be great. And then I'll send online, and I'll also include on the notes, all the links, so that way people can actually, you know, donate. So if you can, definitely donate. I'll be sure to contribute as well. I've just been planning for this, but I'll be sure to do that as well. This was great. I totally enjoyed this time. And please do come back. I think this is the beginning of something really great. And I appreciate the gentleman who called, who's going to actually connect you with some of the information that he thinks would be, valuable to Haiti. I think that's a start. And if you have any other questions, this now is your time, because we are going to wrap up. Ezeli has been extremely gracious. You can just press one, and then I'll see you raise your hand, and I'll actually open your line so you can actually talk. But these are some of the questions that that I've had and I've asked. I hope I asked everything. So wrapping up, I have one more question. There's one more person. Caller 6744, your line is open. So you can go ahead and introduce yourself and ask your question.
How are you doing tonight, ladies?
I am doing well. How are you?
Good, good. This is Avmar Melador. I'm actually friends with Danielle on the 10,000 Haitians. But I've loved everything that I've heard so far. And my family, personally, my father's side of the family, through little donations through their churches, built something in their hometown in Bodari. And the name of that foundation was Project Bodari. But I've always had this thing in my head that the only way to change Haiti is from the bottom up. The trickle-down concept never, ever works. So what you have to do is to start stuff on a small scale and build up. And just saying what they did on their own, just, you know, to working-class people from Haiti. I'm also from Haiti, but they're first generations here. They worked hard. They built a school, and they built a little small clinic. I was talking to my dad yesterday that they actually have a doctor who's a full-time doctor that lives there. So the thing with the solar power as well as clean water is something that is very, that interests me a lot. And I like to, after getting off the phone with all of you and then, you know, through email and the rest, I'll contact you and try to get some ideas about that. Because I have a plan, but that plan, in order for me to initiate it, I'm going to have to go to Haiti, go to that village, see what is needed, and then come back and then put that plan into order. But my thing, I think my question, I think you sort of answered it, in what happened with the ladies and how can they train other women, like the women that are in that village, on how to implement the solar things that they learned. So that's my question.
Right. Thank you for asking the question. And yes, you know, this is one of the reasons why platforms like Daniela's are so critically important, because the NGOs get to tell their story. But to tell you the truth, the people really making any difference in Haiti are the Haitians from the diaspora, not only the remittances, but the ones that have projects like this Project Baudary, right? I'm from the south of Haiti, and that's how we started, too. I think the biggest hospital in the south of Haiti was created by a group of folks in the United States, including my family. But what happens is after that first generation is gone or has gotten older, it doesn't continue. We have to make sure that those things continue, because right now the hospital is being taken over by the NGOs. So I've seen that happen because I'm old and been out here for too long. But so while the women were having their 6 months in India, I got a notice from this lady working for Bunker Roy, who's the president of Barefoot College. Her name is Megan Fallon, to tell me that they would not be dealing with Zilly Blow anymore, because they were going to go to the United Nations to be their contact in Haiti. And I can tell you that, like I said, a year later, Bunker Roy and Barefoot College, who seemed so anti-conformist and so about the poor, was getting a citizenship award from the Clinton Foundation. That's what happened to us. But as I said, you know, we had a contract with the two villages. We continued to finish the first phase, and it was doing I can't remember what the wattage was, but we put solar panels on the energy center, and we gave each of the village market women a public lamp that had, I think, was 8 outlets, so that they can have a little business where they charged the phones, because before then the people had to go down the village, go down to the local, the bottom of the village, to the more urban center to charge their phones. Now they were able to do it and get the money, because what we wanted to do is not only give electricity so that the village could have that, so the people could have education, so the people could have water that was clean, but also so that there would be jobs, local jobs for these women, and then we could replicate that as a model. So once we didn't have the equipment coming to electrify the village, which is what we were going to do, we scaled it down, and as I said, since then I've been looking for a new partner. So I would love to come back, and if we ever find the HBCUs or a partner that had the same sort of vision that we have. But if not, like I said, we're still here doing the water project in Port-au-Prince with La Varisse-Gaudin, but it's very, very, very small. The capacity of that machine is not being used. We're not using 30,000 gallons. And I, as a matter of fact, Mr. Farrakhan had promised us two more machines. We're going to put one somewhere in the north and somewhere in the middle of Haiti. So yes, the vision is to create trade schools in Haiti to deal with the realities of Haitians, not making the people feel that if you're illiterate and you don't speak French, you cannot be of use to your people. We need electricians, we need solar engineers, we need all of that. And I think that it's really important for Haitians, especially school Haitians, to understand that there is a model out there where these women were taught, all of these women coming from all of these very poor countries, war-torn countries, Iraq and so forth, and India, they were taught And they were in a space where they all spoke different languages, and yet they were taught to be solar engineers, and they know how to do this. And so we can do that. We have an illiterate population who have run Haiti and kept and educated children. And that doesn't mean that, you know, they need to have literacy at the moment. We can take them for where they stand. If you're willing to take Haitians from where they stand, I promise you, you will find some surprises as we have.
Wow. That was great. I hope this was helpful. And definitely, we only have about 2.5 minutes left in studio. So I'm going to have to wrap it up. But we can connect offline. I don't know if you follow the Free Haiti Movement Facebook page. That's one way you can actually connect with Ezri. But I'm happy to, you can, you know, send me a direct message and I can send you her information, or you can actually go online so we can kind of, you know, move forward with that. So this was it. Unfortunately, I have about a minute and a half now left almost. I'm going to have to wrap up. Again, thank you so much to all of the listeners, to all of you who called in. It was very, very productive and very, very fruitful. And I appreciate all of you so much for really taking the time to join the show. And Ezri, we'll definitely we'll connect offline as well, because I would love to get that information for the Haitian company, because I wanna write about it as well. And thank you so much for joining us tonight and giving us all this information that you have. And I'm hoping that we can sort of like take it and run with it, as they say. And for the rest of you, if you enjoyed tonight's show, please share it with your network. I will see you on our next show. Thank you so much, everybody. Have a good night.
When we go out to eat, we never agree on where to go.
I want burgers!
Pizza!
Tacos it is.
The one thing we do agree on is we all want unlimited high-speed data. That's why we switched to MetroPCS.
Stop by MetroPCS with the whole family and get 4 lines with unlimited LTE data for just $100, period. MetroPCS. Wireless. Figured out.
Coverage not available in some areas. Requires new line. During congestion, the fraction of customers using more than 35 gigs per month may notice reduced speeds. Video streams at up to 40p. No tethering. See store for details and terms and conditions.
Face it, you're different. Everyone is. Same goes for your banking needs. That's why Columbia Bank offers an impressive range of checking account solutions specifically designed for, well, you. Looking for high-yield interest account? Check. Rewards program? Check. Cash bonuses? Mobile and online banking? Apple Pay? Check. You'll always find more checking choices for you. So check us out at your local Columbia Bank branch or columbiabankonline.com. Count on Columbia.
Equal housing lender and member FDIC.